and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me a bit later will be Candace LaPage. Week 367 of quarantine. No, it's not quite that bad. We are in the middle of July now. We are in Stage 3, as was announced last week. We're still recording these things remotely, though, and that's fun, and it's still going well. Of course, recent news developments show that we will not be probably going back to the theater anytime soon, at least not to see Tenet. It's been delayed again, but that's okay, even though it's indefinite this time. I think we all want to be sure that it'll be safe as houses to go back to the theater again one day. In the meantime, we still have all our streaming services, so on with the show. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror drama Relic, which you can now rent on Apple TV+. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we will continue on with our list of Spielberg's worst to best. Last week, we did the bottom 12. Next week we will do the top 10, and this week we have the middle 11. So it will proceed from sort of misfires of a sort to ones that just almost are among the best, but you can only have the 10 best, so they end up in the middle part of this list. So, without further talking about setting this up, let's get into the actual list. And so I'll start with number 11, which is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It's super fun. A lot of great action. Harrison Ford is great. Adding Sean Connery as Indiana Jones' dad. Great idea. It's back to Nazis. It's back to biblical relics. But, you know, in a sense, it's also very much a carbon copy of Raiders. You could feel that everybody got a bit scared about how dark Temple of Doom was, as I went back to first principles and went back to Raiders and said, huh, what made Raiders less divisive than Temple of Doom? And it's funny because you can sort of compare what happened with Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker to this very kind of debate. Also, what happens between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, it's very much like, we kind of went off our creative rail with that middle chapter, we gotta get back to what worked before. So, that's the reason why Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is at 11. Number 10, kind of a similar predicament. You have The Color Purple, which is comes out in 1985. It is Steven Spielberg's message, like, I am going to do adult crap now. This is me not doing, like, action-adventure and kids on the run and killer sharks and killer monsters and all that. This is straight-up adult storytelling. The problem is, he wasn't ready to go there. Or he wasn't entirely ready to go there. And even Spielberg has mentioned this himself in the HBO doc, which is about his career. He talks about the scene from the book, Alice Walker's book, where it's a scene between two characters, and they're talking about the lead character and her vagina and how her vagina works and how that works in conjunction with sex and pleasure and sex. And it's a very feminist scene. It's a very pro-sex scene. And Spielberg just did not have the, I guess, the boldness and the willingness to really go there and fully invest himself in that scene, which is a shame, because I think the movie works in a lot of different ways. Certainly the sisterhood stuff in there, and the reunion of the sisters in the end, and Whoopi Goldberg's struggles as the main character, and, you know, Oprah Winfrey's character and her struggles in sort of trying to realize her own individuality and her own independence. There's a lot of great stuff in the movie. It just, Spielberg just wasn't quite ready to go there. Number 9 is Bridge of Spies, which feels like two different movies in a sense. You have this one movie, which is about, you know, the justice system, and making sure everybody has access to an attorney, and, you know, no matter how bad you think they are, it's about this communist spy who's taken into custody, and Tom Hanks is a lawyer who ends up having to defend him, and he defends him vigorously within the confines of the law and what is allowed in the law, and it gets him into a certain amount of trouble. It makes him a pariah. It makes his family concerned. And then the second half of the film is this same character played by Tom Hanks is actually sent into East Germany to try and negotiate a trade between this spy played by Mark Rylance and an American spy plane pilot who's been shot down. And because of that, it really feels like there's two different movies going on, two different short films that's like an hour and 10 minutes each. And it's a shame because you really enjoy the stuff between Tom Hanks and Mark Rylance. They are really two great actors getting to play off on each other. And Mark Rylance, oddly enough, considering his age, is a real discovery here, because I believe most of his career has been on the stage. And he's become kind of a bigger movie star ever since, when you think about Dunkirk or Ready Player One, and other things he's been in since Bridge of Spies. Number 8 is Amistad. When I rewatched this a couple of years ago, I found myself warming to it. Again, it's Spielberg in a phase where, like, I am going to do more adult stories, more realistic stories, more grounded stories, as opposed to The Color Purple. This feels more in his wheelhouse. It's kind of a procedural, it's Law and Order. It's still interesting because of all the facets. It's an interesting pre-Civil War story because it's not necessarily about battles or people preparing to do battle or about the political maneuverings. It's about, like, the underlying tensions, the legal issues, how slavery just wasn't like a thing that ended with the Civil War, how there were little steps up to that, and of course, as we see, there are little steps that happened after that as well. So it's a really interesting story. Great cast, too. Number 7 is Sugarland Express, often overlooked because it was the movie right before Jaws, but obviously there's a lot of stuff in Sugarland Express that it was an influence on Spielberg. Going forward, you know, also there's, you know, broken family stuff, obviously, but, you know, there's also a message here about, you know, poverty, people in need, people who get second chances. It's fun and complex too. Great performance by Goldie Hawn in it. It really sets the stage well for what Spielberg would do later in his career. Also, the fact it's kind of too long. Spielberg has that kind of tendency to sort of drag things out, too. Number 6 is Empire of the Sun, which is the film Spielberg made after The Color Purple, but before Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It feels very much like an anti-Spielberg film when you get into it, because it's about a boy separated from his parents, but he's not on, like, some raucous adventure like Elliot and E.T. He's being bounced from place to place. He's being starved. He's being abused. I don't mean to laugh at all that, but it's like a nightmare of an adventure. You follow him as he's basically a POW in this camp near the end of the war. You kind of see a bit of Stockholm Syndrome because he kind of becomes invested in the Japanese pilots who are also near this POW camp, who are going on these kamikaze flights near the end of the war. It's really quite interesting. And of course, it's a great early performance by Mr. Christian Bale. So that brings us to number 5, which is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which is darker. And if you know the background of the film at all, it was during a very dark time for both Spielberg and George Lucas, because they were going through divorces at the time. I mean, they were also sort of at the peak of sort of their creative energies. George Lucas coming off of Return of the Jedi and concluding the Star Wars trilogy. You have Spielberg coming off of E.T., which was at the time the biggest movie of all time. Maybe there was a desperate need in them to do something almost completely different, taking a pre-established character that had been so successful and taking him in completely opposite directions. It's a prequel to the Indiana Jones we meet is a bit more obsessed with fame and money, as opposed to, you know, the classic line in Last Crusade where it belongs in a museum. This Indy is very much more self-centered, and the story is basically about how the Indiana Jones we see in Raiders of the Lost Ark comes about. You also have to overlook, I mean, a lot of blatant racism, the fact that, you know, British Imperial troops are, you know, the heroes at the end when they save the day as the cavalry, I guess. But, you know, easily, I think, some of the best John Williams music. It's a lot of fun. That you have the minecart chase, which is spectacular. You have a lot of really great action. The final standoff on the bridge, where Indiana Jones cuts the bridge in half and everybody falls into the crocodile pit. It is a lot of fun as you get to that action-packed last third. Almost enough to make you forget the racism in the first two thirds. moving on, though. Number four is AI, artificial intelligence, which is the very difficult marriage between Steven Spielberg and Stanley Kubrick and their visions. You have Kubrickian pessimism meeting Spielberg optimism. And it kind of works. It kind of works. I mean, I think, like a lot of people, I have difficulty with the prologue, with the thousands of years in the future and the alien AIs who come to Earth and dig up David and they give him one more perfect day with his human mom. That is problematic because Spielberg is always unwilling to go too dark, even as he's going dark. But it's a real turning point for Spielberg. That, you know, when you seeing AI, you really see how the next 20 years kind of lay out for him in a lot of ways, especially through things like Minority Report, War of the Worlds, Munich. It's an interesting place to see where Spielberg pivots. It's a definite pivot point in his filmography, which is fascinating. Also, another, you know, great Haley Joel Osment performance. Jude Law as his sidekick, the Gigolo Joe robot. A lot of fun. Some good stuff in here. It's definitely worth a rewatch if you haven't watched it in a while. Number three is Adventures of Tintin. Kind of weird that you would think it would rank this high, but it does. Because I feel it is probably the closest Spielberg has gotten to an Indiana Jones movie since 1989. It's a lot of fun. The animation, even though it's mocap, it's not terribly distracting because Spielberg isn't really going for quote-unquote photorealism. There's kind of no Uncanny Valley effect, which is nice. It is kind of a nice update. I mean, I think even if you're not familiar with Tintin, you're probably definitely familiar with the style and the look of the character when he's in 2D version. And it's really updated nicely. You also get Jamie Bell and Andy Serkis as Tintin and Haddock, and they are a very nice team as well. You also get the tonnage of experience that Andy Serkis has with mocap. You can't really do something like this without his input. He is so experienced and has really established a lot of the standards or the principles of mocap acting. So you really get great talent in front of and behind the camera, so to speak. Also, co-produced by Peter Jackson, and that's a weird team-up to have Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg working on the same thing. And, of course, Peter Jackson was supposed to make a reciprocal Tintin movie that he would direct and Steven Spielberg would produce, which has yet to, sadly, materialize. You also get Edgar Wright, Joe Cornish, and Stephen Moffat teaming up on the script. So the creator of Sherlock and the guy who ran Doctor Who for years, teaming up with Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish, who did Shaun of the Dead, and have done a lot of really great and interesting things separately. Joe Cornish has done Attack the Block, Edgar Wright has done, you know, Baby Driver, and Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and all that. Running out of time, so let's talk about Duel number two. Yes, technically released on TV in the United States, but it was released in movie theaters in Europe. So I'm counting it. And here's a... it's weird that this was a TV movie because there's something very cinematic about it. It is a solid, almost like 90-minute chase of this poor man who's being chased by a semi for seemingly no reason. You never find out why the semi has picked on him and why it's choosing him, who's driving the semi. There's a really difficult scene kind of in the middle of the film where the man driving the car stops at a cafe and he's kind of looking around and you hear his inner monologue talking about, who is the truck driver? Is he here with me now? Where is he going? Why is he doing this to me? And it's kind of lame, but it was 1971 or two, and this is kind of like Steven Spielberg's calling card. So, you know, we can forgive certain things with the development, but that's okay. And number one, before we get into the top 10, is Catch Me If You Can. A lot of people point to Hook as Spielberg saying goodbye to childish things. I think Catch Me If You Can is him saying goodbye to childish things. You know, when you have the character of Frank Abagnale, as he's presented in the film, his obsession with getting his parents back together and living this lifestyle as a con artist, where he's going from doctor to lawyer to pilot, all while, like, having the secret wish fulfillment of all he has to do is, like, give his father the tools to reconnect with his mother, and then there will be one big happy family again, even though everybody's clearly moved on, as Frank Abagnale's been off jet-setting and ripping off companies. It's silly. It's a silly, childish mode of thinking, and Spielberg is really kind of blatant about that. And it's about Frank Abagnale coming to terms with that. I'm not sure if that really is Frank Abagnale's story, but that's how Steven Spielberg has interpreted it in Catch Me If You Can. Great Leonardo DiCaprio performance, great Tom Hanks performance. You also get early Amy Adams in there. Just a lot of fun. Great zippy 60s feel. The John Williams score. I think it's one of his best, but I digress because this is not a John Williams recap. It's a Spielberg recap. And next week we will have the top 10. For now, we are going to go and get ready to talk about Relic, which is not a Steven Spielberg film, but it is the film we're reviewing this week. Relic, after this musical break. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And that was a clip from Relic. It is the new film from Natalie Erica James, and it stars Emily Mortimer, Robin Niven, and Bella Heathcote. I am now being joined on the line by Candace LaPage, who generously took a break from binge-watching two long-running series in order to review this week's show. Candace, how are you today?
Thank you. I am great. It was... probably I might be the only person to ever say that Relic was a breath of fresh air, but as you say, I have been binge watching a couple of television shows that, you know, have their ups and downs and downs and downs. It's really Enterprise I'm talking about, but you know.
Yeah. I mean, before we get into the review, I will say that where are you in Enterprise? You're like around season 3, episode, I want to say 8, 9, 10, 0, 6.
Okay.
I could be a few further. Sometimes episodes come and go and I don't even notice because I'm so uninterested in them. So.
No, for sure. But I will say for me personally, I think Enterprise turns around the end of like the first half of season 3. I think it kind of finally finds its footing at that point, because I remember watching it first run, and then they do this bold thing. It's like, we're going to do a whole season line story where they go into this nebula thing and try and answer a mystery. And then like after the first episode, you get like a series of crap burgers that were not exactly in keeping with, let's say, the potential for greatness that is Star Trek. But I do remember that around midpoint season 3 it starts to turn around, so you have that to look forward to.
Okay, good. Yes, and that is why I have continued. I have heard from people that season 3 and 4 and the Zindi storyline, as it's called, does bring out the best of Enterprise, which is still the worst of all the Star Treks, but, you know.
I don't know if it's the worst. I think that's a photo finish between Enterprise and Voyager, but we'll see what you have to say
at the end of it. Anyway,
Let's talk about Relic. It is the one of the latest films that it came out in Sundance at the beginning of this year, 100 years ago, and it is, like a lot of films, was going to get some kind of theatrical release that was canceled because of COVID-19 and the pandemic. So now it's available on VOD. And aside from it dabbling in the horror realm, which has, you know, of the end credits crew, has long been forfeited to you as its brand ambassador, why did you want to see and talk about Relic?
Yeah, well, aside from the horror element, you know, honestly, I do try. I do scroll and I try to find things that are out of my wheelhouse, but I fall back. Come on. But yeah, so I had actually heard quite a few good things about this. On top of it having a streaming release, a VOD release, it has actually been airing at quite a few drive-ins. Drive-in movie theaters started to reopen to the public maybe about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now here in Canada. And presumably there's some in the States that are open as well. And so this, I guess the timing just sort of aligned. So this ended up airing at a number of drive-ins across North America. So there were quite a few sort of podcasts I'd been listening to that had a chance to watch it, and spoke pretty highly of it. And I did not think that it was because it was basically the first movie they'd been able to see on the big screen in months. It did seem genuine that they also were quite taken with the movie. So I definitely wanted to see what it had to offer. And then I did just sort of a really quick look at it, and it was quite clear that this falls into the, whatever we're going to call it now, the genre of, like, art horror or, you know, whatever. I mean, in some ways it's really just a family drama that just sort of takes a real life horror and pushes it to the limit of what it can be, and I was really excited to see it.
I heard a Variety, or I read the Variety review, and it calls this subgenre that includes Get Out, The Witch, other types of movies. They call it smart horror, which I think is kind of a slap in the face if you think about, you know, the Exorcist.
As a person who likes the dumb horror, I won't take that personally.
Right. It's, but you know, there have been smart horrors before. Robert Edgars and Ari Aster got involved.
I sort of think of this as, mood horror, and really liken it to the Black Coat's Daughter.
Yeah, that's a good solid comparison. Yeah, because so much of it is set in a what we would consider a realistic world. There are hints of the supernatural, but it's basically like watching Unsolved Mysteries or Ghost Hunters, where there's some voice in the back of your mind going, "This can be explained. This can be explained. This can be explained." It's not till about you get pretty close to the end, when you get into the deep, very deep into the third act, that things the metaphors start becoming a little more or a little less oblique and a little less implicit, and they start to become more explicit with the revelation that there's supernatural forces at work. Although there are hints about that throughout the movie, but you're right, this could very much just be played straight. This could be a stage drama off Broadway about three generations of women dealing with the difficulty of the elders slide into dementia, and it would work very much the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you're saying just reminded me of Rupert Giles' great quote, where the subtext is rapidly becoming text. is kind of what happens towards the very end. But interestingly, I think this is a type of movie that people who want answers to questions, or people who want like a clear, like, oh, that was the killer, or that was the horror, or that was the whatever, they're not going to get that from this film. And I really like that. You know, I still, even right towards the very end, I still don't necessarily feel that there was a supernatural element to it. You know, they made a real, I mean, essentially, so the matriarch of the family is suffering from dementia. And of course, we don't really know how badly, and it's, you know, we see the movie, unfold. And despite sort of some visual images, to me, I still feel like at the end, it's just dementia. Like, the person just becomes unrecognizable to themselves and to others. And you have to choose whether to keep loving them or not, even though they literally are not the same person. I found this movie to be really moving and really challenging, and not only in the sort of, matriarch who has dementia and how do you deal with that? How do you love this person? But, you know, also in the, because it's a whole line, right? It's a matrilineal line. And so it's about, like, relationship with your own mother, relationship with your own daughter. You know, are you the mother you want to be? Are you the daughter you want to be? How do you break, a line of behavior or of illness or whatever? How do you break that? Or do you just embrace it and understand that that's your lineage, that's the legacy, this illness is the legacy of your family, and you just accept it and understand that eventually you'll be there too. Yeah, I got so much out of this film. And maybe, part of it is because I am a woman, and this was so, to me, spoke so strongly to women and to daughters and the matrilineal line.
It's interesting you talked about sort of coming at this from a female perspective, because from what I understand, Natalie Erica James, and this is her first film, by the way, her first feature film, she's done shorts. I believe the original script had a male protagonist, and so having read interviews with James as well, she brought a lot of her own anxieties and a lot of her real life struggles with women in her family who suffered from dementia. So yeah, there's a real female drive to it, which, I mean, that didn't make me enjoy it any less. I think it's one of those things where sort of having it be three generation of women sort of makes those anxieties and makes those sort of hereditary concerns able to flow better. And you know, that the transference as well, the mother, there's a line in it where the youngest, the granddaughter, Sam, says something to the effect of, well, isn't this how this works? You know, when you're a kid, your parent changes your nappies, and then you change your parents' nappies at the end. Nappies, it's an Australian film, so people may appreciate the change in slang. But yeah, and I think that sort of makes it easier to understand the idea of the role reversal and things going back and forth. It's interesting to me because one of the shows I started getting into this week is Evil, which is from Robert and Michelle King, who did The Good Wife. But Evil is about, well, I guess they're kind of a team. It's a priest in training, a forensic psychologist, and like a tech guy who are employed by the Catholic Church to verify miracles and exorcisms. And one of the subplots of Evil is that the forensic psychologist, who's new to the team, and she's obviously a very Scully-like figure, very skeptical, very science-based. But she is visited occasionally by a demon named George, who is like the figure at the end of Relic. Like, it's all black and dark eyes and scaly and hunched over and things. The George figure, and the series, I'm only three episodes in, but the series plays back and forth. This idea is George like a real demon who is taunting her and torturing her as she sleeps at night, or is this a byproduct of the work she is doing, and now she is experiencing nightmares and night terrors where her subconscious is has developed this entity called George who throws some of her anxieties and fears in her face as she's sleeping at night. And there's a lot of that here too, and I think I agree with you about the it's not even, like, there isn't even really a supernatural presence, and when we see things from the supernatural, or that we can detect as supernatural, that maybe that is some sort of projection that the Emily Mortimer character or the Bella Heathcote character are putting on the situation as a way to kind of absorb it, as a way to kind of translate that from the subtext to the text in their own minds. It just doesn't explain the Labyrinth House.
Well, and that's the thing. So the Labyrinth House actually, I think, you know, it becomes part of that, like I said, sort of the matrilineal line, and the fact that dementia is a rather genetic sort of disease. Though, of course, as we all live longer, we all suffer certain cognitive issues. But, you know, a significant sort of dementia is pretty genetic. And, you know, it almost feels like at that, you know, when Sam, the granddaughter, is sort of lost in the labyrinth, you know, you can see it from a very, like, hey, things are changing around her and it's all... the house, like there's something in the house that's doing whatever, but you can also see it from just a real disorientation sort of place, right? Like she's scared. She's somewhere she's never seen before. Presumably, any sort of secret passage is going to be a little weird, anyways, because it's going to have to work around, like, you know, rooms and things like that. So, you know, some of that could really just be her own sort of steps into, like, her mind just not being able to cognitively put things in the right order, right? This spatially, like, confused. I don't know. I think, I mean, I like that this is so unclear that you really can watch it from both ways. You know, it reminds me a little bit of Donnie Darko in that way, that without the really terrible director's cut that had, like, slides and made some really clear references to the fact that it was science fiction. You know, the first time I watched that movie, it was very, like, this could literally just be the delusions of Donnie. And I was okay with that. Like, to me, I was like, I think that movie is better that way without going into the sort of sci-fi elements. And similarly with this one, I kind of like the read of it better where there isn't necessarily a supernatural element, or, you know, extra natural, I'll say. Like, you know, dementia, all those, like, it's terrifying. Like, I found this movie to be really, they did such a great job of really explaining and really showing how terrifying that illness can be for everyone involved, you know, for the person who's suffering from it and for the people around them. What I found was really interesting, because this is an Australian film, there is a short scene where Kay, Emily Mortimer's character, goes to visit a home in Melbourne. And not to get too political, but clearly right now, a lot of people are talking about long-term care and how we care for and treat our senior citizens and our elders, especially as they start to need a lot more attention. And I've heard so many people reference the Australian model and how it's so much better. And this film really did not, you know, lead me to believe that. And I don't think it was meant to. You know, part of it was when Kay went to go look at a home, and she just was really disappointed with it. And I think, you know, this does talk a lot about, yeah, how do we care for our elders? Because it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword in this case, right? The grandmother, the gran, was so sick, she really, really needed care and support from people who were trained to deal with it. But to just put her somewhere where those people are, where she's also then surrounded by a number of other people, and what are the ways that they take care of that care and support? Is it through just, you know, medicating them until they aren't angry anymore? I don't know. It's such a, it's a really challenging conversation that I think a lot of people have to have a lot more. And, you know, maybe this is going to be the beginning of a real sort of look at this in horror more, because horror is, like I say, horror is best when it's a reflection of our sort of societal norms, our cultural norms, and when it's asking, is this what you want it to be like? And right. This is a topic I think people will be talking about for a really long time as we all age.
Right. It's interesting to say, well, a lot of people say, look to the Australian model. And I think this goes to an idea that, you know, for everybody, the grass is always greener, right? You know, a lot of Americans look at what we have here in Canada in terms of healthcare and think, that is amazing. That's the way it should be. Meanwhile, those of us here in Canada are like, well, we are aware of the problems with our system. Here's problem A, problem B, problem C, all that. Our drugs are not covered. Our eyes are not covered. Our teeth are not covered. Blah, 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 blah. Again, not to get political, as you said, but I remember reading a thing for Open Sources a couple of weeks back when we were talking about the long-term care issues. I think it was an op-ed, but somebody made the point that, you know, baby boomers, their entire life, there has been accommodations made. Like, when people came back from the war, you know, they built housing after the war, you know, they had, you know, there were, you would graduate from high school, you'd go get right into a job, you'd have your job waiting, your health care would be covered. You know, it was easy to get into the housing market. It, you know, it was easy to sort of build a life for yourself every step along the way. But now that we are here with baby boomers approaching end of life, that conversation never happened. How baby boomers are, how so many people getting old at the exact same time and needing palliative care or hospice care or whatever, that has never been addressed. And so now we're kind of making it up as we go. And one of the things I liked about this is that it acknowledges there's no easy answers, because there is that scene, like you said, where Emily Mortimer goes to the long-term care home and, you know, wasn't great, but it didn't seem like it should be on 60 Minutes or anything. But, you know, you can understand why going into someplace like that, you would think, you know, this is the last place I'd want to put my parent. And then you have Sam, the granddaughter, saying, well, why don't I come and move in and look after you and, you know, do the cooking and cleaning and make sure, you know, you're okay. And of course, this is all precipitated by the fact that Kay and Sam drive up to this house, which seems almost in the middle of nowhere, or at very least a very rural setting, because no one's heard from their grandmother for days. And of course, that, you know, we've heard those stories a lot, these shocking stories, some of them right here in Guelph, of older people with dementia or dementia-like symptoms, you know, wandering away, and fortunately they are found because of various apps and things, and, you know, but it's deeply concerning, and you know, it is dealt with in a very realistic way. And I think a lot of credit goes to Robin Niven as Edna, the grandmother, because I think she plays it very subtly, and like there's really kind of no big blah moment. Like there's really no acting like a monster, even if we're just talking about monsters metaphorically. It's a very grounded performance. It feels very real. It feels very disturbing. It feels very much like you're watching this person deteriorate. And it's very hard to play things that small. It's always easier to play them big. But I think that's what Relic really does so well, is just, as we've been sort of alluding to, it's just everything is just so grounded so well that it's not just a matter of like feeling like you're watching a horror, although you are. You're watching a slice of life, and sometimes slice of life is horrific.
Yeah, I do think that she did a great job, Robin Niven, in this role, because, you know, she had to play, you know, between being scared to being scary. And then also, you know, there were moments in there where you could see the grandmother that the granddaughter loves. So, you know, she really had to play like every sort of role here, and did a really, I was quite impressed with her performance. I've maybe seen her in the past, but I, you know, didn't recognize her right away. Clearly she's a very well trained actor, I would say. I mean, it's sort of one of those things where there are visual images that we, you know, in general, sort of agree are scary. You know, it's why you get so many clowns in things. And the sort of nude older person is one of those. And who knows why, right? It probably says a lot about us that an older person who is nude standing there is scary to us. I'm sure there's psychological reasons there, but you know, this film really started with that, but then as you continue on this journey with this woman, you see her as so much more than that. you know, even I think definitely the most touching part of the film being when she's trying to bury the photo album with out in the forest with Kay, where it's just like, you know, this woman that you started the very sort of opening scene is a little bit frightening of her, and then she's stern, and then she's sort of loving with her granddaughter, and then you see her just so vulnerable in that moment, and it's like, yeah, I'm very impressed by her performance entirely, and just like the writing of that character.
Yeah, that's that scene you're talking about. I think that was one of my, I don't want to say complaints because that seems too big, but like the scene where she's actually burying the photo album. That there's something really beautiful about that. But you know, leading up to that, where she's actually eating the photos, I thought that seems a little on the nose. So far as metaphors go, but you know, yeah, it's. She has to play, as you said, she has to play all the angles. And there are some genuinely frightening scenes that, you know, that have nothing, again, nothing to do with supernatural. It's just, you know, you feel the scariness and the loneliness and the emptiness of sort of watching someone you love slide into this this malaise, this kind of really dark phase of life where, you know, you at one minute you're giving an heirloom to your granddaughter, and then the next minute you're accusing her of stealing. It's difficult, and it's, you know, and it's hard to watch, even though, you know, these are fictional characters. And yeah, it's powerful, and also tight. I want to say it's tight. I like the movie itself. It's like 90 minutes long, and like Natalie James sort of understands that you don't want to linger in this, that, you know, length does not necessarily mean better. She really knows how to, you know, sort of maximize every scene and really build on one scene and the other. And she knows, you know, when it's time to wrap things up and when it's time to get out. And you know, that's, I think that's a rare gift, because I think the training is just like longer means better, and that's not always the case. She really understands the economy of making sure she hits all the story beats and that she doesn't linger. Although, you know, there are a lot of really great scenes, a lot of really quiet scenes, but I there's not like a lot of fat on this movie too. It is very lean, and it gets you to where it needs to take you. And that's all there is to it. And you know, so, sometimes shorter is better. I want to leave that opinion out there.
When it comes to horror movies, 88 minutes is perfect. And for you sure. know, 90 is even better if it's a slow, moody horror.
Right, and this goes by very, very quick, too. You know, even though nothing even sort of remotely kind of supernatural happens until the very end, but, you know, it is very slick, it is very quick, and it gets you to where you need to go.
Mm-hmm. I will say, just sort of from the technical aspect, so I had to watch this film on my laptop because it was only available through Apple. Unfortunately, in Canada, it's not available through Google or YouTube. So typically,
found
I have
that
a Chrome.
Out the hard way.
Yeah, I have a Chromecast, so of course, you know, I can't watch Apple TV things on my TV. So I had to watch on my laptop, which means the sound, of course, I couldn't really adjust as much. It was at maximum, and my air conditioner was still very loud. So I put my headphones on, which sometimes I feel like I should watch more films with my headphones on because you hear so much more. But the sound in this film was really, really good. It really set the mood very well when it first started and I put my headphones on. I was a little concerned that I might not be able to watch it with the headphones on because there are a couple of sounds in sort of the very beginning that are a little creepy. Primarily, I'm talking about kind of the when the title screen comes up, Relic. It's there's sort of like a throat croaking sound for it, which was, you know, a little on the creepy side, but the just the sound in general, and I think it really helps with the mood, because it was the sound across, like throughout the entire film, was pulsing, I would say. So you either heard like pulsing like breathing, or pulsing like a heartbeat, or sort of the knocking sound, which isn't quite pulsing, but it was still, you know, repetitive and in a pattern. And it was just, I just found that so striking that it, I mean, in some ways it really sort of slowed everything down to just the sound primarily just being like a slow pulse. And it really brought me in to the film, which of course there's, you know, as we talked about how short the film is, some of the scenes do linger, as you say, and there's just this sort of dread that often doesn't really, there are no jump scares, which is great. So it's just this sort of mounting dread the whole time, basically just slowly amped up by this pulsing sound that you continue to hear throughout the entire film.
Yeah, there's no real score per se, at least not one that I detected. It's just that background hum through the whole time. And of course, you know, there's a very famous conspiracy theory about people who can hear hums wherever they go. They hear the background hum that drives them mad. And there's very much an aspect to that here. And yeah, like everything, like I love the lighting. It feels very real. It feels, again, feels very grounded. I did like the line in that Variety review I mentioned, where the reviewer said, you know, if somebody just went and bought a couple of 100-watt bulbs, maybe some of the anxiety would go away. But
yes, it's a little dark.
But I mean, it's basically kind of a haunted house drama. Or a haunted house movie, so, you know, that kind of thing's to be expected. And it uses the sort of the trappings of horror really well, again, to tell a story that, you know, it is, can be taken as not supernatural. And until you sort of get to those ending scenes, it's kind of, as we've said, it's not really supernatural at all. It's about, you know, struggling with age, struggling with how you deal with parents or people in your life who are aged, and how it's not so easy to deal with them. And it's hard not to walk away from this movie if you have, you know, sort of living parents who are in their senior years without thinking of, I hope I don't have to deal with this.
What's my plan? Okay, let's start working on this.
Yeah, what's the plan? Yeah. And yeah, great work from the cast, especially Emily Mortimer, who I don't think has ever really gotten her due, although she's kind of existed in Hollywood for, you know, 20 years. I don't think she's ever really gotten, like, Oscar nominations or award consideration. Not that I'm necessarily nominating her here, but, you know, it's nice to see good actors do good work in good movies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, agreed.
Agreed, yeah.
So, Candace, if people want to talk more about things, or, you know, have maybe future movie recommendations for you, where can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. I am everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, CINN48. And on Twitter is primarily where I'm doing all of my complaining about Enterprise and the other television show I'm rewatching, being The Vampire Diaries. So, you know, if you want to complain with me, join me there. And if you want to suggest more movies I should watch, that's probably the best place to.
I will not be joining you in complaining about The Vampire Diaries, FYI.
I know. I tried already.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. As always, if you would like to listen again, You can feel free, find us on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. It can also be found on Twitter and Instagram anytime at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca, and I write about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street, which you can find at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.